Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them. And our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Friday Center in Chapel Hill, it's Friday, February 16th, 2018. This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Joining you and us today on the line from Charlotte is Jim Morrill, longtime reporter at the Charlotte Observer. Hi, Jim. How are you?
Hey, Jeff. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for being here. Plenty of political developments this week, many in Raleigh, many in Washington. For updates on those, you can, on the latest Berger Cooper spat, some of the dysfunction that's playing out in the White House, as well as other stories, you can visit our website, WUNC.org. Unfortunately, we're going to start our conversation today with, I think, what's the story of the week. It comes out of Florida. And that's where the latest mass shooting took place at a high school in Parkland. 17 people, many of them children, died in this massacre. And this has become really a terrible cycle from my perspective of, an incident, a debate on social media, sometimes involving politicians. There it tends to be several days of heightened emotion and calls for action. And we have not seen much in the way of action as this cycle has kind of replicated itself time and time and time again over the last several years. Jim, you've done some reporting about one of the big factors in this whole thing, which is the NRA and, you know, its involvement as a political player. You had a story that ran again this week. Just give me the top line, the main takeaways from that as we get into this.
Well, you're right. You know, the NRA has been a big contributor in elections, not only directly to candidates, but they've been spending a lot of money on people's behalf, and that's what we found in North Carolina. In fact, Senator Burr ranked second in help from the NRA over the years, and Senator Tillis, our other senator, is fourth, and this is among all the U.S. senators. Only John McCain has got more money. But the thing about this story is that, we first ran it back in October after the Las Vegas shooting. That's when the Center for Responsive Politics, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which tracks campaign money, I think, better than anybody in the country, came out with a report about that. And so they updated the report yesterday. I know we requested it, and some other people did, and it's basically the same. So they've gotten a lot of help from the NRA. In 2016, for example, the NRA spent $5.5 million against Burr's opponent, Deborah Ross, and Tillis got a lot of help in 2014 when the NRA spent a lot of money against Kay Hagan in the form of TV ads and stuff. So, you know, the fact that we're recycling stories essentially shows you where we are in this country, that not much has gotten done.
Has Senator Tillis or Senator Burr spoken to you about this issue, about the couple of stories that you've done pertaining to this?
No, they haven't. You know, we reached out to their people, their offices, and sort of got from Tillis's office, frankly, all we got was the senator's tweet that he had sent out right after the Florida shootings about, extending his sympathies and everything. And there was a brief statement from Senator Burr's aide, but, neither one of these guys is coming out for any kind of new gun control or extended background checks, as far as I know. So, after Las Vegas, a big talk in Washington, people introduced a bill about bump stocks. You remember that? You know,
that's
the shooter. The shooter used in Las Vegas to make an assault style rifle resemble more of an automatic weapon, and so there was legislation introduced that would ban bump stocks, but that hasn't happened either.
And not only has it not happened, it really, there's been no movement on it. Do you have a sense of why that is. Is that coming from leadership in the U.S. House or Senate? Is that because of direct pressure applied from the NRA or other special interest groups? I mean, there was a lot of talk about that right after the massacre in Las Vegas. And then, again, I mentioned that cycle off the top. It seemed to just dissipate and go away.
Yeah, you know, all these things sort of dissipate and go away. There's a lot of talk after all these incidents. And unfortunately, there have been a lot of them, even in the past 6 months. But, you know, whether it's from the NRA, pressure from the NRA, there just doesn't seem to be the will on the part of congressional leadership to do this. You know, I think it, to a large extent it's become a partisan issue, and that doesn't help it. But there's just nothing being done. You know, some people talk about common sense legislation, like more extensive background checks. The New York Times had a story that you may have seen yesterday about that it's easier to buy an AR-15 rifle weapon in Florida than it is to buy a handgun. And if you buy a handgun, it takes at least a 3-day waiting period. You can go in and pass an instant background check and walk out of a store with an AR-15. So, you know, there's a lot of, seems like there's a lot of room to do something here.
You mentioned the partisan nature of this, and I want to touch on that and also push back on it. I believe that latest report that you referenced a couple of minutes ago notes that the NRA, there are no Democrats they give to. Is that correct? Did that come out in that report, or am I conflating another article I've read? Do you remember?
I can't remember if it was none, but it was definitely not much.
Right. I think when we're talking, the way I'm trying to frame this up is, it's certainly a very partisan issue in D.C. and within the political circles, the elected official circles. One of the things that strikes me, though, is that this seems to, at least certain things, I mean, based on research that Pew has done and that other polling that, you know, we've seen that has come out, there is a lot of support for background checks. There is a lot of support for some measures, which, you know, we hear common sense, we hear reasonable. Do you have a sense of what the breaking point could be on this? Because there are plenty of political issues where the action of the politicians does not reflect the people. But this, to me, seems like one of the most disproportionate that we have today in our country.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, I mean, I saw one of those polls that you're talking about. I think it was Quinnipiac poll that had 95% of the people supporting more extensive background checks, and that doesn't even happen. You know, I think people are just politicians, candidates are so afraid of the Second Amendment, of stepping on that sort of third rail that nothing gets done. You know, as soon as I got emails after the story that we did about the NRA money from the gun rights group in North Carolina, you know, that was critical of us. You know, I mean, and I'm not running for anything,
let me interrupt, and I'm sorry to cut you off, but just to stick with that, what was their beef? What was their criticism of that story, of your story?
They made it sound, he said, Paul Vallone, who's the head of the North Carolina Gun Rights Group, said that it made it sound like the NRA was giving money directly to Richard Burr and Tom Tillis, which they weren't, but we said in the story that they were spending the money on their behalf. When you buy TV ads against, you know, when you spend millions of dollars on TV ads against their opponent, you're helping that person out, or whether you're putting money in their campaign coffers or not. So that was their beef, but
sure.
You know, it's just hard. I mean, I agree with you that some of these things seem like no-brainers, but nothing's gotten done, right?
And whether I guess I would also note whether it's let me try to find something relatively innocuous, like the Salvation Army, or whether you're donating to a charity or a candidate. People usually do that because they believe in the cause, believe in the person, believe in the entity, whatever it may be, right?
Well, right, and also to influence them. I mean,
sure.
You can't say that that's not part of it. I mean, you know, you tend to listen to people that help you a lot, and you know, not pointing fingers here, but you know, that's, you got to think there's some connection between contributions and help, and of course the NRA doesn't just work with money. I mean, they don't just help candidates with money. As you know, they have a big grassroots effort. They have members around the country, many in North Carolina, thousands in North Carolina. You know, so they activate their grassroots people too. You know, I don't know if the NRA is the whole reason for the logjam on this issue in Congress, but it's got to be part of it.
For sure. And I think, to be fair, obviously the NRA is a huge player. At the same time, we have a culture of guns in this country, and I think reasonable people can agree on that. We have, I believe, more guns per capita than maybe any other country in the world, except for Yemen. Yemen's like right up there with the U.S. in terms of the number of guns, you know, relative to the number of people. Let me ask you this, and this is a bit of a curveball or a question that I don't think comes up too frequently, but you know, we're a nation of checks and balances, and if legislatively nothing's going to move on this gun debate, I think about, you know, what's happened here in North Carolina in recent years, not to weigh in on the good or the bad of it, but there have been a lot of legal challenges. There have been a lot of lawsuits over redistricting and laws that, you know, folks have said are unconstitutional. Some of those have been successful lawsuits. Some of them have not. What do you hear about there being, you know, an appetite or an avenue for a lawsuit or going, you know, a litigious way as we think about this whole gun conversation?
You know, that's an avenue for sure. You know, I think people have tried that, you know, in cases where you're talking about like suits against the manufacturers and like that. I mean, there have been suits challenging gun control laws that have gone to the Supreme Court.
But, right.
You know, that's a possibility. I mean, we're a litigious society, but, you know, and another thing is that after every incident like that, you think, well, maybe this is a breaking point. Maybe Las Vegas was the breaking point. Maybe the Texas church was a breaking point. Maybe whatever the shooting of the week is a breaking point. And people are saying that now. I mean, you've had some very emotional outbursts from parents on television from Florida. There was a woman who got a lot of TV play whose daughter was killed, and she just implored President Trump in the strongest words to do something about it. And students are starting to speak out. So I think after every shooting like this, there's people who speak out and say this is going to be it, and maybe this will be it, but I don't know. You know, I think we've all seen too many of these to realistically expect a lot of change.
Right. I would unfortunately agree with you on that. I think it's inevitable till we're having this conversation again, either with each other or someone else.
You know, I can imagine that, you know, if this happens again in a few weeks or a few months, we would run basically the same story that we did, you know, about NRA contributions to the candidates. And, you know, because people always talk about it. I mean, those kind of stories get a lot of play, a lot of attention. A lot of people are talking today all over the country about the NRA and why things don't get done in Washington, why government can't protect people more. You know, we have a North Carolina legislator here in Concord nearby that is talking about arming teachers. You know, I don't know that would be the answer. I know a lot of people disagree with that idea, but...
Right,
you know,
and that,
maybe.
Right, and I would even, I probably should bite my tongue on that. I've talked to plenty of Republicans, and then you're talking about Larry Pittman, who's a Republican in the North Carolina House, and
right.
I'll put this through the lens of several Republicans who I've talked to who say that Larry Pittman is a problem for their party, that he needs to go, and that his ideas are fringy and ridiculous. I mean, I've heard that word, ridiculous, from Republicans talking about Larry Pittman, not on the record, not in front of a microphone. But sure, I mean, I don't know if that discourse, if that idea really helps anything, right? Like, let's arm the teachers that's out
well,
there.
Well, you're right. And but in truth, I don't think he's the only one
absolutely.
In the legislature who comes from that point of view.
Jim Morrill writes for the Charlotte Observer, and he's chatting with me, and you're listening to him here on the WUNC Politics Podcast. Unfortunately, more, I imagine, to come on this this conversation and debate and cycle as we head deeper into 2018. Jim, you cover, I mean, you've covered this issue. You also cover politics locally in Charlotte. You've covered statewide politics plenty. And you mentioned the North Carolina House just a moment ago. That's perhaps the biggest electoral question mark as we barrel toward 2018. Supermajorities are the Republicans are trying to maintain them, trying to defend them. And there's a key race, I think one of maybe a dozen races that are going to be really competitive, maybe 10 to 12 that are interesting, that are competitive down across the state. But one in Mecklenburg County, there's a lawmaker named Bill Brawley, and he got a challenge this week from someone with at least one name, a last name that we I think a lot of people are going to be familiar with. Tell us a little bit about that race and who the challenger is.
Yeah, you know, this was sort of a surprise to a lot of us, but Rachel Hunt filed against Brawley in that district. She's the daughter of former Governor Jim Hunt, making her first run for office. She's been involved in a lot of things in the community. She's got, like her father, her big issue appears to be education. In fact, she's got a company, at least one company of her own, that deals in education. So, you know, just by virtue of her name recognition and what that might mean in terms of support and money in that race, it could make it interesting. Now, in fairness, Bill Brawley's district it changed like a lot of districts have, but I don't think that much in terms of Republican strength in that district. For example, there are a couple districts, Republican-held districts here in Mecklenburg alone, three legislative districts that are held by Republicans but voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016. Brawley's was not one of them. It did change, but maybe not politically that much. But it might be a test of, Democratic excitement this year. You know, if you, it seems like if anybody could get Democrats pumped and excited, it's a Democratic woman with the last name of Hunt, you know, especially if her father comes in and helps campaign a little bit. But, you know, we had a lot of energy here from the women's marches, just like I'm sure you did up there. And, a lot of women are still very motivated. And so that could be one of the races where we see what difference it makes, if any.
Jim Hunt, former four-term governor of North Carolina, not consecutive, two consecutive two-term stretches. Do you have any sense of how active or involved he will be in the campaign, on the campaign trail, in advertisements or mailers? I mean, still one of the most influential names, or at least one of the most prominent historical political names in the state, I think.
Oh, definitely. I don't, and he might want to be cautious about it, to be honest with you. You know, if he were to get it involved, that would be an easy fundraising tool for his opponent and generate as much support for his Republican opponent from that side as it gives her on the Democratic side. You know, and Bill Brawley is an influential legislator, as you know. I mean, he's the chairman of the Finance Committee.
Mm-hmm.
He's just got the chairmanship of a new committee that was formed last week about breaking up, looking at the possible breakup of school districts in Mecklenburg and Wake County.
Yep,
which could be interesting running against Rachel Hunt. You know, could throw education right into the middle of that race.
Going to be an interesting race for sure.
I think it'll generate a lot of attention and money on both sides.
Right. Let me ask you this. What is one race, either in the Mecklenburg delegation or perhaps elsewhere in the state, that you will be keeping an eye on as we, you know, get through this year?
Well, there's a couple here. There's three races here, actually. One is a Senate race. Jeff Tart, who's a Republican from Cornelius. His district got flipped around. It sort of ran down the eastern side of Mecklenburg County in previous elections, and now it runs down the western side and has new suburbs, new precincts, and that's one of the districts that went for Hillary Clinton in 2016. So, you know, that'll be an interesting one to watch. And he's got an opponent who's been on the ballot before, and she's pretty well known from up in Davidson. And then there's the couple suburban southern districts. You know, Southeast Charlotte has always been a Republican stronghold, but there are a couple districts down there that went for Hillary Clinton. You know, and so suburban women are going to be a big big factor in those districts. And anecdotally, I hear that, you know, Democratic women, based on a couple precinct organizing meetings, are pretty organized and motivated down there. So those might be interesting. And then, you know, I guess you have the same thing in Wake County to look at in some of those races. So I think it'll be an interesting year. And you mentioned, a dozen or so competitive races. I mean, the Democrats need four seats, a net gain of four seats in the House and six in the Senate, so to break the supermajorities at least. So you never know.
And the smart people, or at least the people who I regard as smarter than me, think that there are more competitive seats, and it's more in question in the House. I think it's a longer shot for Democrats to end a supermajority in the Senate. And also, as just a caveat, very few people, if any, think that there's that we're going to see a wave like we saw in Virginia, where the Democrats would take back either of the chambers. I think that would surprise just a lot of people. But candidate filing underway, primary in May, and then the general election, of course, in November. And one thing we haven't talked a lot about is a state Supreme Court seat is on the ballot this year as well. Jim Morrill of the Charlotte Observer, let's get you out of here on a couple of lighter ones. You no longer run marathons, but you ran several. What's one marathon course you never ran, but you wish you had?
I never ran in Charlotte. Charlotte, the Observer used to have a marathon that, you know, was a big deal here for years, and I never did that one, and I don't know why, but, you know, they always had 10Ks along with it, and I used to do those, but...
I was going to ask if they made you work it or something, if they're making you work overtime and cover
no.
the event. Okay, good.
Yeah.
You're a Cubs fan, longtime Cubbies fan. You're originally from the Midwest. If you could go back in time or resurrect one of them and have dinner with either Ron Santo or Ernie Banks, who are you sitting across from?
I think Ernie. You know, he was like a childhood idol. You know, I still have a little plastic statue of him in my son's bedroom. My son has inherited Cubs loyalty. So, but definitely him. You know, he just for his personality outgoingness, and you know, plus he was good. Plus he was.
He was great.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't remember that, but from what I've read, he was great. Give me a prediction for the Cubs this year.
Well, I think they'll have a little tougher time in the Central, but I think they'll pull it out and you know, meet the Dodgers again in the National League Championship Series.
And you'll reserve a prediction on that till October.
Well. Yu Darvish is on our side now, so I don't know if he'll be the Yu Darvish of old or the Yu Darvish of the World Series when he kind of stunk up the place for the Dodgers. So
is Darvish going to start on opening day, or will Johnny Lestis start on opening day?
You know, I think Lester.
Okay, I think so too, but I was just wondering.
Yeah.
All right, we'll leave it there. Jim Morrill, okay. Charlotte Observer, thank you for coming on the podcast and chatting about an array of topics here.
Nice to talk to you.
And as always, thanks for listening. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and leave us a comment or a rating there if you are so inclined. And, of course, stay up to date with all the happenings in North Carolina politics and beyond at our website, WUNC.org. For Jim, I'm Jeff. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you next week.
Shut down on State Street, that great street. I just want to say they do things they don't do on Broadway.